The ether dripped onto the face mask more freely than usual. His hand kept slipping off the cone before he could get enough to satisfy himself. He turned a little toward the wall. That way, the edge of the windowsill maintained contact with the mask over his mouth and nose after his fingers relaxed their grip. There was just enough pressure from the windowsill to hold the cone in place. This time he traveled to Paris. How lively it was there at the end of World War I. The young doctor was constantly embraced by the natives. He remembered sitting with an American soldier, an amputee, in a café. All the patrons brought them cognac. The soldier put out his cigar and a snifter of cognac that he couldn't finish, not if he intended to stand on his crutches with his one leg. And Wilbur Larch breathed deeply of that aroma. That was how Paris smelled, like cognac and ash. That and like perfume. Larch had walked the soldier home. He'd been a good doctor, even there, even then. He was a third crutch to the drunken man. He was the man's missing leg. That was when the woman had accosted him. She was a whore, quite clearly, and she was quite young and quite pregnant. Larch, who didn't understand French very well, assumed that she wanted an abortion. He was trying to tell her that she was too late, that she'd have to go through with having this baby, when he suddenly understood that she was asking only what a whore is usually asking. "Plaisir d'amour?" she asked him. The amputated soldier was passing out in Larch's arms. It was to Larch alone that the woman was offering the pleasure of love. "Non, merci," Wilbur Larch mumbled. But the soldier collapsed. Larch needed the pregnant prostitute to help carry him. When they delivered the soldier to his room, the woman renewed her offer to Wilbur Larch. He had to hold her at arm's length to keep her away from him. And still she would slip through his grasp and push her firm belly into him. "Plaisir d'amour," she said. "No, no," he told her. He had to wave his arms to keep her away. One hand, swinging back and forth beside the bed, knocked over the ether can with the loose pin. Slowly the puddle developed on the linoleum floor. It spread under the bed and all around him. The strength of the fumes overpowered him. The woman in Paris had smelled very strongly, too. Her perfume was strong, and stronger still was the effluvia of her trade. By the time Larch moved his face away from the windowsill and the cone fell, he was already gagging. "Princes of Maine," he tried to call for them, but he didn't make a sound. "Kings of New England." He thought he was summoning them, but no one could hear him, and the French woman lay down beside him and snuggled her heavy belly against him. She hugged him so tightly that he couldn't breathe, and her flavorful, tangy aroma made the tears run down his cheeks. He thought he was vomiting. He was. "Plaisir d'amour," she whispered. "Oui, merci," he said, giving in to her. "Oui, merci." The cause of death would be respiratory failure, due to aspiration of vomit, which would lead to cardiac arrest. The Board of Trustees, in light of the evidence submitted against him, would privately call it a suicide. The man was about to be disgraced, they told themselves. But those who knew him and understood his ether habit would say that it was the kind of accident a tired man would have. Certainly Mrs. Grogan knew, and Nurse Angela, and Nurse Edna, and Nurse Caroline knew, too, that he was not a man about to be disgraced. Rather, he was a man about to be no longer of use. And a man of use, Wilbur Larch had thought, was all that he was born to be. Nurse Edna, who for some time would remain almost speechless, found his body. The dispensary door was not a perfect seal, and she thought that the odor was especially strong, and that Dr. Larch had been in there longer than usual. Mrs. Grogan, who hoped he'd gone to a better world, read in the voice of a troubled thrush a quavering passage of Jane Eyre to the girls' division. "An orphan loves and needs routine," the women reminded each other. Nurse Caroline, who was tough as nails and found Dickens a sentimental bore, had a firm grasp of the language. She read aloud an almost hearty passage of David Copperfield to the boys' division, but she found herself broken by the prospect of the expected benediction. It was Nurse Angela who said it all, according to the rules. "Let us be happy for Dr. Larch," she said to the attentive children. "Dr. Larch has found a family." "Good night, Dr. Larch," Nurse Angela said. "Good night, Dr. Larch," the children called. "Good night, Wilbur," Nurse Edna managed to say, while Nurse Angela summoned her strength for the usual refrain, and Nurse Caroline, who hoped the evening wind would dry her tears, marched down the hill to the railroad station, once again to inform the frightened station master that there was a body in St. Cloud's. That Sunday at Ocean View was an Indian summer day, and Homer Wells was fishing. Not real fishing. Homer was trying to find out more about the relationship between Mr. Rose and his daughter. The two men sat on the cider house roof. For the most part, they weren't talking. Not talking too much, Homer assumed, was the only way to go fishing with Mr. Rose. Below them, Angel was trying to teach Rose how to ride a bicycle. Homer had offered to drive Rose and Angel to the beach, and to drive back and pick them up at some designated hour, but it mattered to Angel that he and Rose were independent. To be driven to the beach only emphasized that he was still waiting to be old enough to get his driver's license. The beach was too far to walk to, and Homer wouldn't allow Angel to hitchhike, but it was only a 4 or 5 mile ride on a bike, and the road was mostly flat. Mr. Rose observed the lesson placidly, but Homer grew anxious for Rose to succeed on the bicycle. He knew how much preparation had gone into the proposed trip, how Angel had fussed over both his own and Candy's bicycles, and how Angel had discussed with Candy which of Candy's bathing suits would be the most suitable for Rose. Together they had chosen an emerald green one. It had one pink spiraled barber pole stripe, and Candy was sure the suit would fit Rose better than it fit her. It had always been too loose in the bust and in the hips for Candy. "It's the kind of thing you're supposed to learn when you're a little kid, I guess," Homer Wells observed of the bicycle lesson. Angel would run alongside the wobbly bicycle, which Rose struggled to ride. After the bike was moving at a comfortable speed, Angel would release his hold on it. Rose would either not pedal, hugging the bike until it simply ran out of speed and toppled, or else she would pedal furiously but without guidance. She seemed unable to balance the bicycle and pedal it at the same time, and her hands appeared frozen on the handlebars. For her to balance and pedal and steer simultaneously looked increasingly like a distant miracle. "Can you ride one?" Mr. Rose asked Homer. "I never tried," said Homer Wells. "I'd probably have a little trouble," he admitted. It looked easy enough to him. There were no bicycles at the orphanage. The children might have used them to ride away. The only bicycle in St. Cloud's was the station master's, and he rarely rode it. "I never tried either," said Mr. Rose. He watched his daughter careen over a slight hill. She shrieked, the bike jackknifed, she fell, and Angel Wells ran to her to help her up. A line of men sat with their backs against the cider house wall. Some were drinking coffee, some were drinking beer, but all of them watched the bicycle lesson. Some were encouraging, and as vocal as local fans rooting at a sporting event, and others watched the procedure as placidly as Mr. Rose. It had been going on for a while, and the applause, what there'd been of it, grew spottier and more random. "Don't give up," Angel said to Rose. "I'm not giving up," Rose said. "Did I say I was giving up?" "You remember what you said to me once about the rules?" Homer asked Mr. Rose. "What rules?" Mr. Rose asked. "You know, those rules I put up every year in the cider house," Homer said. "And you mentioned that you had other rules, your own rules for living here?"
"Yeah, those rules," Mr. Rose said.
"I thought you meant that your rules were about not hurting each other. I thought they were about being careful," Homer said. "Sort of like my rules, too, I guess."
"Say what you mean, Homer," said Mr. Rose.
"Is someone getting hurt?" Homer asked. "I mean, this year, is there some kind of trouble?" Rose was up on the bicycle. Her look was grim,
Both she and Angel were sweating. It appeared to Homer that Rose Rose was jouncing on the seat too hard, almost intentionally hurting herself, or else she was treating herself so roughly in order to give herself the intensity she needed to master the machine. She wobbled off a knoll out of sight behind some apple trees, and Angel sprinted after her.
"Why don't they just walk?" the picker named Peaches asked. "They could have been there by now." "Why don't someone take them in some car?" another man asked. "They want to do it their own way," Muddy said.
There was a little laughter about that.
"Show some respect," said Mr. Rose.
Homer thought Mr. Rose was speaking to him, but he was speaking to the men, who stopped laughing.
"Pretty soon, that bicycle gonna break," Mr. Rose said to Homer.
Rose Rose was wearing a pair of blue jeans, some heavy work shoes, and a white T-shirt. Because she was sweating, the outline and the colors of the emerald green and pink bathing suit were visible through her shirt.
"Imagine her learning to swim," said Mr. Rose.
Homer Wells felt bad for Angel, but another subject weighed more heavily on his mind.
"About someone being hurt," Homer said. "About the rules."
Mr. Rose reached into his pocket, slowly, and Homer half expected to see the knife. But it was not the knife that Mr. Rose removed from his pocket and very gently placed in Homer's hand. It was the burned-down nub of a candle. It was what was left of the candle Candy had lit for their lovemaking in the cider house. In her panic, when she thought it was Wally who had caught them there, she had forgotten it. Homer closed his fingers around the candle, and Mr. Rose patted his hand.
"That 'gainst the rules, ain't it?"
Mr. Rose asked Homer. Black Pan was baking cornbread, and the smell rose from the cider house and hung deliciously over the roof, which was warming in the late morning sun. Pretty soon it would be uncomfortably hot on the roof.
"Ain't that bread ready to eat yet?"
Peaches hollered into the kitchen.
"No, it ain't," Black Pan said from inside the cider house. "And pipe down or you wake the baby."
"Shit,"
Peaches said. Black Pan came outside and kicked Peaches, not terribly hard, where he was leaning against the cider house wall.
"When that bread ready, you won't call it shit, will you?"
Black Pan asked him.
"I wasn't calling nothing shit, man. I was just saying it," Peaches said.
"Just pipe down," Black Pan said.
He observed the bicycle lesson.
"How it coming with that?" he asked.
"They trying hard," Muddy said.
"They inventing a new sport," Peaches said, and everyone laughed.
"Show some respect,"
said Mr. Rose, and everyone piped down. Black Pan went back inside the cider house.
"What you bet he burns the bread?" Peaches asked quietly.
"If he burns it, 'cause he took the time to kick your ass," Muddy told him.
The bicycle was broken. Either the rear wheel wouldn't turn, or else the chain was jammed in the wheel.
"There's another bicycle," Angel told Rose Rose. "You try that one while I fix this one."
But while he fixed Candy's bicycle, Rose Rose had to suffer with a boy's bicycle, so that in addition to her troubles, she slipped and hurt her crotch against the crossbar. Homer was actually worried about how hard a fall she had, and he asked her if she was all right.
"It's just like a cramp,"
she called to him, but she remained bent over until Angel managed to get Candy's bicycle running again.
"It looks hopeless," Homer confided to Mr. Rose.
"What about them rules?"
Mr. Rose asked him. Homer put the candle in his pocket. He and Mr. Rose regarded each other. It was almost a contest, the way they looked at each other.
"I'm worried about your daughter," said Homer Wells, after a while.
Together they watched Rose Rose fall off the bicycle again.
"Don't worry about her," said Mr. Rose.
"She looks unhappy sometimes," Homer said.
"She ain't unhappy," Mr. Rose said.
"Are you worried about her?" Homer asked him. "'Once you start worrying, you can worry about anybody, can't you?' said Mr. Rose.
It appeared to Homer Wells that her fall against the crossbar was still giving Rose some pain, because she stood for a while with her hands on her knees and her head down, as if her stomach hurt her, each time she fell off the bicycle. Homer and Mr. Rose missed the moment when she gave up. They just noticed that she was running off, in the direction of the orchard called Frying Pan, and that Angel was running after her. Both bicycles were left behind. "'That's too bad,' Homer said. "'They would have had a good time at the beach. Maybe I can convince them to let me drive them there.'
"'Leave 'em alone,' said Mr. Rose.
The way Homer heard it, it was more of a command than a suggestion.
"'They don't have to go to no beach,' Mr. Rose said more mildly. "'They just young, they not sure how to have a good time,' he said. "'Just think what might happen at the beach. They might get drowned, or some people might not like seeing a white boy with a colored girl, and they both in bathing suits. "'It better they don't go nowhere,' Mr. Rose concluded. That was the end of that subject, because then Mr. Rose asked, "'Are you happy, Homer?'
"'Am I happy?' said Homer Wells.
"'Why you repeat every single thing?' Mr. Rose asked him.
"'I don't know,' Homer said. "'I'm happy sometimes,' he said cautiously.
"'That good,' said Mr. Rose. "'And Mr. and Mrs. Worthington, are they happy?'
"'I think they're pretty happy most of the time,' Homer told him.
"'That good,' said Mr. Rose.
Peaches, who'd had a few beers, approached Angel's bicycle warily, as if the machine were dangerous even when it was lying on the ground.
"'Careful it don't bite you,' Muddy warned him.
Peaches mounted the bike and grinned at the men.
"'How do it start?'
he asked them, and they all laughed. Muddy got up from against the wall and went over to Candy's bicycle.
"'I have you a race,' he said to Peaches.
"'Yeah,' said Black Pan in the cider house door. "'We see which one of you falls down first.'
"'Mine ain't got no middle,' Muddy observed of Candy's bike. "'That make it go faster,' Peaches said.
He tried to move Angel's bike forward, as if his feet were paddles.
"'You ain't riding that thing, you fucking it,' one of the men said, and everyone laughed.
Black Pan ran up behind Peaches and started pushing him faster.
"'Cut that shit out!'
Peaches cried, but Black Pan got the bike rolling so fast that he couldn't keep up with it.
"'I can't be in no race if someone don't push me too,' Muddy said,
and two of the men got him rolling faster than Peaches, who had disappeared over a hill into the next field, from which the men could hear him screaming.
"'Holy shit!'
said Muddy when he was underway. He pedaled so hard that the front wheel rose off the ground, and then the bicycle rode right out from under him. The men were howling now, and Black Pan picked up Muddy's fallen bicycle. He was the next to try it.
"'You gonna try it, too?' Mr. Rose asked Homer.
As long as Angel and Candy weren't around to watch him, Homer thought he would. "'Sure,' Homer said.
"'I'm next,'
he yelled at Black Pan, who was balancing the bicycle in place, his feet slipping off the pedals. He fell over on his side before he could get moving.
"'That was no real turn,' Black Pan said. "'I'd get another try.'
"'Are you going to try it?' Homer asked Mr. Rose.
"'Not me,' said Mr. Rose.
"'The baby's crying,' someone said.
"'Go pick her up,' said someone else.
"'I'll take care of that,' said Mr. Rose to all of them. I'll watch the baby. You all play.
Peaches appeared over the hill. He was walking the bicycle beside him, and he was limping.
It hit a tree, he explained. It went right at the tree like the tree was its enemy. You supposed to steer it, Muddy told him. It steer itself, Peaches said. It don't listen to me.
Homer supported Black Pan while the cook mounted Candy's bike a second time.
Here we go.
Black Pan said with determination, but he kept one arm wrapped around Homer's neck. He had only one hand on the handlebars, and he wasn't pedaling.
"'You've got to pedal to make it go,' Homer told him.
"You got to push me first," Black Pan said.
"Something burning," someone shouted.
"Oh, shit, my cornbread," Black Pan said.
He lunged to one side, his arm still around Homer's neck, so that Homer fell over with him, on top of the bicycle.
"I told you he was going to burn that bread," Peaches told Muddy.
"Give me that bike," Muddy said, taking Angel's bike away from Peaches. Two of the men were giving Homer a push.
I got it," Homer told them, so they let go.
But he didn't have it. He veered sharply in one direction, then he veered back toward the men, who had to run out of his way. Then he jackknifed the bike and went tumbling one way, the bike went another. Everyone was laughing now. Peaches looked at Homer Wells lying on the ground.
"Sometimes it don't help if you white," Peaches told Homer, and everyone howled.
"It help if you white most of the time," said Mr. Rose.
He stood in the cider house door, the smoke from the burning cornbread billowing behind him, his daughter's daughter in his arms, the pacifier a seemingly permanent fixture in her mouth. And after Mr. Rose had spoken, he stuck a pacifier in his mouth, too. In the heart of the valley that was at the bottom of Frying Pan, where the ocean might be 100 miles away and no breath from the sea ever reached, Rose was stretched out in the dark green grass under a northern spy that no one had picked yet. Angel Wells was stretched out beside her. She let her arm loll on his waist. He ran his finger very lightly over her face, following the line of her scar down her nose to her lip. When he got to her lip, she held his hand still and kissed his finger. She had taken off the work shoes and the blue jeans, but she kept Candy's bathing suit and a T-shirt on.
"Wouldn't have had no fun at no beach anyway," she said.
"We'll go another day," Angel said.
"We won't go nowhere," she said.
They kissed each other for a while. Then Rose said,
"Tell me about it again."
Angel Wells began to describe the ocean, but she interrupted him.
"No, not that part," she said. "I don't care about no ocean. Tell me about the other part, where we all living together in the same house. You and me and my baby and your father and Mr. and Mrs. Worthington," Rose said.
"That the part that get to me," she said, smiling. And he began again about how it was possible. He was sure that his father and Wally and Candy wouldn't object.
"You all crazy," she told Angel. "But go on," she said.
There was plenty of room, Angel assured her.
"Ain't nobody gonna mind about the baby?" she asked him.
She shut her eyes. With her eyes shut, she could see what Angel was describing a little better. That was when Angel Wells became a fiction writer, whether he knew it or not. That's when he learned how to make the make-believe matter to him more than real life mattered to him. That's when he learned how to paint a picture that was not real, and never would be real, but in order to be believed at all, even on a sunny Indian summer day, it had to be better made and seem more real than real. It had to sound at least possible. Angel talked all day. He just went on and on and on. He would be a novelist before nightfall. In his story, Rose and everyone else got along famously. No one objected to anything anyone else did. All of it, as they say in Maine, worked out. Sometimes Rose cried a little. More often they just kissed. Only a few times did she interrupt him, usually because she wanted him to repeat something that had seemed especially unlikely to her. "Hold on a minute," she'd say to Angel. "Better go over that again, 'cause I must be slow." In the late afternoon, the mosquitoes began to bother them, and it crossed Angel's mind how, some evening, Rose would ask Wally to tell her what the rice paddy mosquitoes were like.
"An ocean view mosquito isn't anything compared to a Japanese bee mosquito," Wally would have told her.
But Angel didn't get to tell Rose this part of the fantasy. She was starting to stand up when an apparent cramp, or the pain from her fall against the bicycle's crossbar, dropped her to her knees as if she'd been kicked, and Angel caught her around her shoulders.
"You hurt yourself on the bicycle, didn't you?" he asked her.
"I was trying to," she said then.
"What?"
he asked her.
"I was trying to hurt myself," Rose told him.
but I don't think I hurt myself enough. Enough for what? He asked.
To lose the baby, she told him.
You're pregnant? Angel asked her.
Again, she said.
Again and again, I guess, she said. Somebody must want me to keep having babies.
Who? Angel asked her.
Never mind, she told him.
Someone who's not here? He asked.
Oh, he here, Rose said. But never mind.
The father is here? Angel asked.
The father of this one?
Yeah, he here, she said, patting her flat stomach.
Who is he? Angel asked.
Never mind who he is, she told Angel.
Tell me that part again. Only better make it two babies.
Now they me and you and everybody else and two babies, she said. Won't we all have fun?
Angel looked as if she'd slapped him.
Rose kissed him and hugged him, and she changed her tone of voice.
You see, she whispered to him, holding him tight, we wouldn't have had no fun at no beach, Angel.
Do you want the baby? He asked her.
I want the one I got, she told him. I don't want this other one.
She struck herself as hard as she could when she said other. She bent herself over again. She knocked the wind out of herself. She lay in the grass in what Angel could not help observing was a fetal position.
You want to love me or help me? She asked him.
Both, he said miserably.
Ain't no such thing as both, she said. If you smart, you just stick with helping me. That easier.
You can stay with me, Angel began again.
Don't tell me no more about that, Rose said angrily. Don't tell me no more names for my baby either. Just plain help me, she said.
How? Angel asked. Anything, he told her.
Just get me an abortion, Rose said. I don't live round here, I don't know nobody to ask, and I got no money.
Angel thought that the money he had been saving to buy his first car would probably be enough for an abortion. He had saved about $500. But the problem was that the money was in a savings account, the trustees of which were his father and Candy. Angel couldn't take any money out without their signatures. And when Angel called Herb Fowler at home, the news regarding the abortionist was typically vague.
"There's some old fart named Hood who does 'em," Herb told Angel. "He's a retired doctor from Cape Kenneth, but he does the business in a summer house over in Drinkwater. Lucky for you, it's still almost summer. I heard he does 'em in the summer house even if it's the middle of the winter."
"Do you know what it costs?" Angel asked Herb.
"A lot," Herb said, "but it don't cost as much as a baby."
"Thanks, Herb," Angel said.
"Congratulations," Herb Fowler told the boy. "I didn't know your pecker was long enough."
"It's long enough," Angel said bravely. But when Angel looked in the phone book, there was no Dr. Hood among the many Hoods in that part of Maine, and Herb Fowler didn't know the man's first name. Angel knew he couldn't call everyone named Hood and ask each time if this was the abortionist. Angel also knew he'd have to speak to Candy and his father in order to get the money, and so he didn't delay in telling them the whole story.
"God, what a good boy Angel is," Wally would say later. "He never tries to keep anything from anybody. He just comes right out with it, no matter what it is."
"She wouldn't tell you who the father is?" Homer Wells asked Angel.
"No, she wouldn't," Angel said.
"Maybe Muddy," Wally said.
"Probably Peaches," Candy said.
"What does it matter if she doesn't want to say who the father is?"
"The main thing is she doesn't want the baby," said Homer Wells.
"The main thing is to get her an abortion."
Wally and Candy were quiet. They wouldn't question Homer's authority on this subject.
"The problem is, how do we know which Hood to call when the phone book doesn't say which one is the doctor?" Angel asked.
"I know which one it is," Homer said, "and he's not a doctor."
"Herb said he was a retired doctor," Angel said.
"He's a retired biology teacher," said Homer Wells, who knew exactly which Mr. Hood it was.
Homer also remembered that Mr. Hood had once confused a rabbit's uteri with a sheep's.
He wondered how many uteri Mr. Hood imagined women had. And would he be more careful if he knew a woman had only one?
A biology teacher? Angel asked.
Not a very good one, either, Homer said.
Herb Fowler has never known shit about anything, Wally said.
The thought of what Mr. Hood might not know gave Homer Wells the shivers.
She's not going anywhere near Mr. Hood, Homer said. You'll have to take her to St. Cloud's, he told Angel.
But I don't think she wants to have the baby, Angel said. And if she had it, I don't think she'd want to leave it in the orphanage.
Angel, Homer said, she doesn't have to have a baby in St. Cloud's. She can have an abortion there.
Wally moved the wheelchair back and forth.
Candy said, I had an abortion there once, Angel.
You did, Angel said.
At the time, Wally told the boy, we thought we'd always be able to have another baby.
It was before Wally was hurt, before the war, Candy began.
Dr. Larch does it? Angel asked his father.
Right, said Homer Wells. He was thinking that he should put Angel and Rose Rose on a train to St. Cloud's as soon as possible. With all the evidence that had been submitted to the Board of Trustees, Homer didn't know how much more time Dr. Larch would have to practice.
I'll call Dr. Larch right now, Homer said. We'll put you and Rose Rose on the next train.
Or I could drive them in the Cadillac, Wally said.
It's too far for you to drive, Wally, Homer told him.
Baby Rose can stay here with me, Candy said.
They decided that it would be best if Candy went to the cider house and brought Rose Rose and her baby back to the house. Mr. Rose might give Rose Rose an argument if Angel showed up at night, wanting Rose Rose and the baby to go off with him.
"You won't argue with me," Candy said. "I'll just say I found a lot of old baby clothes and that Rose Rose and I are going to dress up the baby in everything that fits her."
"At night?" Wally said. "For Christ's sake, Mr. Rose isn't a fool."
"I don't care if he believes me," Candy said. "I just want to get the girl and her baby out of there."
"Is there that much of a rush?" Wally asked.
"Yes, I'm afraid there is," said Homer Wells. He had not told Candy or Wally about Dr. Larch's desire to replace himself, or what revelations and fictions had been delivered to the board. An orphan learns to keep things to himself. An orphan holds things in. What comes out of orphans comes out of them slowly. When Homer called St. Cloud's, he got Nurse Caroline. In their shock, in their grief, in their mourning for Dr. Larch, they had determined that Nurse Caroline had the sturdiest voice over the phone. And they had all been trying to familiarize themselves with Dr. Larch's plans for everything, and with his massive A Brief History of St. Cloud's as well. Every time the phone rang, they assumed it was someone from the Board of Trustees.
"Caroline," said Homer Wells, "it's Homer. Let me speak with the old man."
Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna, and even Mrs. Grogan, would love Homer Wells forever, in spite of his note of denial. But Nurse Caroline was younger than any of them. She did not feel the abiding sweetness for Homer Wells that comes from knowing someone when he's a baby. She felt he had betrayed Larch, and of course it was a bad time for him to ask for the old man. When Larch had died, Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna and Mrs. Grogan had said they were not up to calling Homer. Nurse Caroline hadn't wanted to call him.
"What do you want?" Nurse Caroline asked him coldly. "Or have you changed your mind?"
"There's a friend of my son's," said Homer Wells. "She's one of the migrants here. She's already got a baby who's got no father, and now she's going to have another."
"Then she'll have two," Nurse Caroline informed him.
"Caroline," said Homer Wells, "cut the shit. I want to talk to the old man."
"I'd like to talk to him, too," Nurse Caroline told him, her voice rising.
"Larch is dead, Homer," she said more quietly.
"Cut the shit," said Homer Wells. He felt his heart dancing.
"Too much ether," she said. "There's no more Lord's work in St. Cloud's. If you know someone who needs it, you'll have to do it yourself." Then she hung up on him. She really slammed the phone down. His ear rang. He heard the sound of the logs bashing together in the water that swept the Winkles away. His eyes had not stung so sharply since that night in the draper's furnace room in Waterville when he had dressed himself for his getaway. His throat had not ached so deeply, the pain pushing down into his lungs, since that night he had yelled across the river, trying to make the Maine woods repeat the name of Fuzzy Stone. Snowy Meadows had found happiness with the furniture marshes. Good for Snowy, thought Homer Wells. He imagined that the other orphans would have difficulty finding happiness in the furniture business. At times, he admitted, he had been very happy in the apple business. He knew what Larch would have told him, that his happiness was not the point, or that it wasn't as important as his usefulness. Homer shut his eyes and watched the women getting off the train. They always looked a little lost. He remembered them in the gaslit sleigh. Their faces were especially vivid to him when the sled runners would cut through the snow and strike sparks against the ground. How the women had winced at that grating sound. And, briefly, when the town had cared enough to provide a bus service, how isolated the women had seemed in the sealed buses, their faces cloudy behind the fogged glass. Through the windows they had appeared to Homer Wells the way the world appeared to them, just before the ether transported them. And now they walked from the station. Homer saw them marching uphill. There were more of them than he'd remembered. They were an army, advancing on the orphanage hospital, bearing with them a single wound. Nurse Caroline was tough, but where would Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela go? And what would happen to Mrs. Grogan, worried Homer Wells. He remembered the hatred and contempt in Melanie's eyes. If Melanie were pregnant, I would help her, he thought. And with that thought he realized that he was willing to play God, a little. Wilbur Larch would have told him there was no such thing as playing a little God. When you were willing to play God at all, you played a lot. Homer Wells was thinking hard when he reached into his pocket and found the burned-down nub of the candle Mr. Rose had returned to him. "That 'gainst the rules, ain't it?" Mr. Rose had asked him. On his bedside table, between the reading lamp and the telephone, was his battered copy of David Copperfield. Homer didn't have to open the book to know how the story began. "Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show," he recited from memory. His memory was exceedingly keen. He could recall the different sizes of the ether cones that Larch insisted upon making himself. The apparatus was rudimentary. Larch shaped a cone out of an ordinary huckaback towel. Between the layers of the towel were layers of stiff paper to keep the cone from collapsing. At the open tip of the cone was a wad of cotton to absorb the ether. Crude, but Larch could make one in 3 minutes. They were different sizes for different faces. Homer had preferred the ready-made Yankauer mask, a wire mesh mask shaped like a soup ladle, wrapped with 10 or 12 layers of gauze. It was into the old Yankauer mask on his bedside table that Homer deposited the remains of the cider house candle. He kept change in the mask, and sometimes his watch. Now he peered into it. The mask contained a piece of chewing gum in a faded green wrapper, and the tortoiseshell button from his tweed jacket. The gauze in the mask was yellow and dusty, but all the mask needed was fresh gauze. Homer Wells made up his mind. He would be a hero. He went downstairs to the kitchen where Angel was pushing Wally around in the wheelchair. It was a game they played when they were both restless. Angel stood on the back of the wheelchair and pushed it the way you push a scooter. He got the chair going faster and faster, much faster than Wally could make it move by himself. Wally just steered. He kept turning and turning. Wally tried to miss the furniture, but despite his skill as a pilot and the good size of the kitchen floor, eventually Angel would get the chair going too fast to control and they'd crash into something. Candy got angry at them for it, but they did it anyway, especially when she was out of the house. Wally called it flying. Most of all, it was something they did when they were bored. Candy had gone to the cider house to get Rose Rose and her baby. Angel and Wally were freewheeling. When they saw how Homer looked, they stopped. "What's the matter, old boy?" Wally asked his friend. Homer knelt by Wally's wheelchair and put his head in Wally's lap. "Dr. Larch is dead," he told Wally, who held Homer while he cried. He cried a very short time. In Homer's memory, Curly Day had been the only orphan who ever cried for a long time. When Homer stopped crying, he said to Angel, "I've got a little story for you, and I'm going to need your help." They went outside to the shed where the garden things were kept, and Homer opened one of the quarter-pound ether cans with a safety pin. The fumes made his eyes tear a little. He'd never understood how Larch could like the stuff. "He got addicted to it," Homer told his son. "But he used to have the lightest touch. I've seen patients talking back to him while they were under, and still they didn't feel a thing." He took the ether upstairs, and Homer told Angel to make up the extra bed in his room, first with the rubber sheet they'd used when Angel had been still in diapers, then the usual sheets, but clean ones over that. "For baby Rose?" Angel asked his father. "No, not for baby Rose," Homer said. When he unpacked the instruments, Angel sat down on the other bed and watched him. "The water's boiling," Wally called upstairs. "You remember how I used to tell you that I was Dr. Larch's helper?" Homer asked Angel. "Right," said Angel Wells. "Well, I got very good at helping him," Homer said. "Very good. I'm not an amateur," he told his son. "That's really it. That's the little story," Homer said, when he'd arranged everything he needed where he could see it. Everything looked timeless. Everything looked perfect. "Go on," Angel Wells told his father. "Go on with the story." Downstairs in the quiet house, they heard Wally in his wheelchair, rolling from room to room. He was still flying. Upstairs, Homer Wells was talking to his son while he changed the gauze on the Yankauer mask. He began with that old business about the Lord's work and the devil's, how, to Wilbur Larch, it was all the work of the Lord. It startled Candy, how the headlights from her jeep caught all the men in the starkest silhouettes against the sky, how they were perched in a row like huge birds along the cider house roof. She thought that everyone must be up there, but not everyone was. Mr. Rose and his daughter were inside the cider house, and the men were waiting where they'd been told to wait. When Candy got out of the jeep, no one spoke to her. There were no lights on in the cider house. If her headlights hadn't exposed the men on the roof, Candy would have thought that everyone had gone to bed. "Hello," Candy called up to the roof. "One day that whole roof is going to cave in." It suddenly frightened her how they wouldn't speak to her. But the men were more frightened than Candy was. The men didn't know what to say. They knew only that what Mr. Rose was doing to his daughter was wrong, and that they were too afraid to do anything about it. "Muddy?" Candy asked in the darkness. "Yes, Mrs. Worthington," Muddy called down to her. She went over to the corner of the cider house where the roof dipped closest to the ground. It was where everyone climbed up. An old picking ladder was leaned up against the roof there, but no one on the roof moved to hold the ladder steady for her. "Peaches," Candy said. "Yes, ma'am," Peaches said. "Please, someone hold the ladder," she said. Muddy and Peaches held the ladder, and Black Pan held her hand when she climbed up on the roof. The men made room for her, and she sat down with them. She could not see very clearly, but she would have known if Rose Rose was there, and if Mr. Rose had been there, Candy knew he would have spoken to her. The first time she heard the sound from the cider house, it came from directly under her. Candy thought it was the baby, just babbling or maybe beginning to cry.
"When your Wally was a boy, it was different out there," Black Pan said to her. "It looked like another country then."
His gaze was fixed upon the twinkling coast. The noise under the cider house roof grew more distinct, and Peaches said, "Ain't it a pretty night, ma'am?"
It was decidedly not a pretty night. It was a darker night than usual, and the sound from the cider house was now comprehensible to her. For a second, she thought she was going to be sick.
"Careful when you stand up, Mrs. Worthington," Muddy said to her. But Candy stamped her feet on the roof. Then she knelt down and began to beat on the tin roof with both her hands.
"It's so old a roof, Mrs. Worthington," Black Pan said to her. "You best be careful you don't fall through it."
"Get me down, get me off," Candy said to them. Muddy and Peaches took her arms, and Black Pan preceded them to the ladder. Even walking down the roof, Candy tried to keep stamping her feet. Going down the ladder, she called, "Rose?" She could not say the ridiculous name of Rose Rose, and she couldn't make herself say Mr. Rose either. "Rose?" she called ambiguously. She wasn't even sure which one she was summoning, but it was Mr. Rose who met her at the cider house door. He was still getting dressed. He was tucking his shirt in and buttoning his trousers. He looked thinner and older to her than he'd looked before, and although he smiled at her, he didn't look into her eyes with his usual confidence, with his usual polite indifference.
"Don't you speak to me," Candy told him. But what would he have said? "Your daughter and her baby are coming with me."
Candy walked by him into the cider house. She felt the tattered rules with her fingers as she found the light. Rose Rose was sitting up on the bed. She had pulled her blue jeans on, but she hadn't closed them, and she had pulled the T-shirt on, but she held Candy's bathing suit in her lap. She was unfamiliar with wearing it, and she'd not been able to put it on in a hurry. She had found only one of her work shoes, which she held in her hand. The other one was under the bed. Candy found it and put it on the correct foot. Rose Rose wore no socks. Then Candy tied the laces for her, too. Rose Rose just sat on the bed while Candy put on and tied her other shoe.
"You're coming with me, your baby, too," Candy told the girl.
"Yes, ma'am," Rose Rose said. Candy took the bathing suit from her and used the suit to wipe the tears from Rose Rose's face.
"You're fine, you're just fine," Candy said to the girl. "And you're going to feel better. No one's going to hurt you."
Baby Rose was sound asleep, and Candy was careful not to wake her when she picked her up and handed her to her mother. Rose Rose moved uncertainly, and Candy put her arm around her when they walked out of the cider house together.
"You're going to be just fine," Candy said to Rose Rose. She kissed the young woman on her neck, and Rose Rose, who was sweating, leaned against her.
Mr. Rose was standing in the darkness between the jeep and the cider house, but the rest of the men still sat on the roof.
"You coming back?" Mr. Rose said.
Nothing was raised at the end of his voice. It was not a question.
"I told you not to speak to me," Candy told him.
She helped Rose Rose and her baby into the jeep.
"I was speaking to my daughter,"
Mr. Rose said with dignity.
But Rose Rose would not answer her father. She sat like a statue of a woman with a baby in her arms, while Candy turned the jeep around and drove away. Before they went into the fancy house together, Rose Rose slumped against Candy and said to her,
"I never could do nothing about it."
"Of course you couldn't," Candy told her.
"He hated the father of the other one," Rose Rose said. "He'd been after me ever since."
"You're going to be all right now," Candy told the girl before they went inside.
Through the windows they could watch Wally flying back and forth in the house.
"I know my father, Mrs. Worthington," Rose Rose whispered. "He gonna want me back."
"He can't have you," Candy told her. "He can't make you go back to him."
"He make his own rules," said Rose Rose.
"And the father of your beautiful daughter?" Candy asked, holding the door open for Rose Rose and her baby girl. "Where is he?"
"My father cut him up. He long gone," Rose Rose said. "He don't want to be involved with me no more."
"And your mother?" Candy asked as they went in the house.
"She dead," Rose Rose said.
That was when Wally told Candy that Dr. Larch was dead, too. She would not have known it to look at Homer, who was all business. An orphan learns how to hold back, how to keep things in.
"Are you all right?" Candy asked Homer,
while Wally wheeled Baby Rose around the downstairs of the house, and Angel took Rose Rose to his room, which was prepared for her. "I'm a little nervous," Homer admitted to Candy. "It's certainly not a matter of technique, and I've got everything I need. I know I can do it. It's just that, to me, it's a living human being. I can't describe to you what it feels like, just to hold the curette, for example. When living tissue is touched, it responds, somehow," Homer said, but Candy cut him off. "It may help you to know who the father is," she said. "It's Mr. Rose. Her father is the father, if that makes it any easier." The crisply made-up bed in Angel's childhood room and the gleaming instruments, which were displayed so neatly on the adjacent bed, made Rose Rose both talkative and rigid. "This don't look like no fun," the girl said, holding her fists in her lap. "They took the other one out through the top, not the way she was supposed to come out," Rose Rose explained. She'd had a cesarean, Homer Wells could see, perhaps because of her age and her size at the time. But Homer could not quite convince her that this time everything would be much easier. He wouldn't need to take anything out through the top. "Go stay with Wally, Angel," Candy told the boy. "Go give Baby Rose a ride in the wheelchair. Knock over all the furniture if you want," she told him, kissing her son. "Yeah, you go away," Rose Rose told Angel. "Don't be afraid," Candy told Rose Rose. "Homer knows what he's doing. You're in very safe hands." She swabbed Rose Rose with the red methylate, while Homer began to show Rose Rose the instruments. "This is a speculum," he said to her. "It may feel cold, but it doesn't hurt. You won't feel any of this," he assured her. "These are dilators," Homer said, but Rose Rose shut her eyes. "You done this before, ain't you?" Rose Rose asked him. He had the ether ready. "Just breathe normally," he told her. At the first whiff, she opened her eyes and turned her face away from the mask, but Candy put her hands at Rose Rose's temples and very gently moved her head into the right position. "The first smell is the sharpest," said Homer Wells. "Please, have you done this before?" Rose Rose asked him. Her voice was muffled under the mask. "I'm a good doctor, I really am," Homer Wells told her. "Just relax and breathe normally." "Don't be afraid," Rose Rose heard Candy tell her, just before the ether began to take her out of her body.
"I can ride it," she said.
Rose Rose meant a bicycle. Homer watched her wiggle her toes. Rose was getting her first feel of the sand. The beach was warm. The tide was coming in. She felt the water around her ankles. "No big deal," she murmured. Rose Rose meant the ocean. Homer Wells, adjusting the speculum until he had a perfect view of the cervix, introduced the first dilator until the os opened like an eye, looking back at him. The cervix looked softened and slightly enlarged, and it was bathed in a healthy, clear mucus. It was the most breathtaking pink color that Homer had ever seen. Downstairs, he heard the wheelchair careening through the house. There was a wild and non-stop giggling from Baby Rose. "Tell them not to get that baby overexcited," Homer said to Candy, as if she were his nurse of long standing, and he was used to giving her directions, and she was used to following them exactly. He did not let the ruckus, or Candy trying to quiet them down, distract him. He watched the cervix open until it opened wide enough. He chose the curette of the correct size. After the first one, thought Homer Wells, this might get easier. Because he knew now that he couldn't play God in the worst sense. If he could operate on Rose Rose, how could he refuse to help a stranger? How could he refuse anyone? Only a god makes that kind of decision. "I'll just give them what they want," he thought. "An orphan or an abortion." Homer Wells breathed slowly and regularly. The steadiness of his hand surprised him. He did not even blink when he felt the curette make contact. He did not divert his eye from witnessing the miracle. For that night, Candy slept in the extra bed in Angel's room. She wanted to be close by if Rose Rose needed anything. But Rose Rose slept like a rock. The gap left by her missing tooth made a small whistling noise when her lips were parted. It was not at all disturbing, and Candy slept quite soundly, too. Angel slept downstairs, sharing the big bed with Wally. They stayed awake quite late, talking. Wally told Angel about the time he first fell in love with Candy. Although Angel had heard the story before, he listened to it more attentively, now that he thought he had fallen in love with Rose Rose. Wally also told Angel that he must never underestimate the darker necessities of the world where his father had grown up.
"It's the old story," Wally said to Angel. "You can get Homer out of St. Clouds, but you can't get St. Clouds out of Homer."
"And the thing about being in love," Wally said to Angel, "is that you can't force anyone. It's natural to want someone you love to do what you want, or what you think would be good for them, but you have to let everything happen to them. You can't interfere with people you love any more than you're supposed to interfere with people you don't even know. And that's hard," he added, "because you often feel like interfering. You want to be the one who makes the plans."
"It's hard to want to protect someone else and not be able to," Angel pointed out.
"You can't protect people, kiddo," Wally said. "All you can do is love them."
When he fell asleep, Wally felt the movement of the raft on the Irrawaddy. One of his friendly Burmese rescuers was offering to catheterize him. First he dipped the bamboo chute in the brown river, then he wiped it dry on one of the strips of silk that bound up his head basket. Then he spat on it.
"You want to peace now?" the Burmese asked Wally.
"No, thank you," Wally said in his sleep.
"No piss now," he said aloud, which made Angel smile before he fell asleep, too.
Upstairs in the master bedroom, Homer Wells was wide awake. He'd volunteered to have Baby Rose for the night.
"Because I'll be up all night anyway," he said.
He'd forgotten how much he enjoyed having a baby to look after. Babies reminded Homer of himself. They were always wanting something in the middle of the night. But after he'd given Baby Rose her bottle, the child went back to sleep and left Homer Wells alone again. It was nonetheless a pleasure having the little girl to look at. Her black face in the bed beside him was no bigger than his hand, and occasionally her hands would reach up and her fingers would open and close, grasping at something she saw in her sleep. The presence of another breather in the room reminded Homer Wells of the sleeping quarters in St. Clouds, where he had some difficulty imagining the necessary announcement.
"Let us be happy for Dr. Larch," Homer said softly. "Dr. Larch has found a family. Good night, Dr. Larch."
He tried to imagine which one of them would have said it. He imagined it would have been Nurse Angela, and so it was to her that he sent the letter. Now that Dr. Larch had died, Mrs. Goodhall's pleasure at the thought of replacing the old non-practicing homosexual was less intense. It did stimulate her, however, to imagine replacing him with that young missionary who had antagonized him so. Dr. Gingrich saw some faint justice appear on the horizon at the thought of replacing Larch with someone who'd clearly driven the old man crazy. But Dr. Gingrich was not so interested in the outcome of the situation in St. Clouds as he was fascinated with his secretive study of Mrs. Goodhall's mind, in which he found such a complex broth of righteous delusion and inspired hatred. Of course, Dr. Gingrich and the other board members were eager to meet young Dr. Stone, but Dr. Gingrich was particularly eager to observe Mrs. Goodhall at such a meeting. Mrs. Goodhall had developed a tic. Whenever someone provided her with unusual pleasure or displeasure, the right side of her face suffered an involuntary muscular contraction. Dr. Gingrich imagined that, upon meeting the missionary doctor, Mrs. Goodhall would enter a phase of nearly constant spasm and he could not wait to observe this.